Night after night, we sat in front of the telly with a ham sandwich in one hand, a bar of chocolate in the other, and a bottle of lemonade between our boots, while Mam was with some fancy man upstairs on the new bed she'd ordered. And I'd never known a family as happy as ours was in that couple of months when we got all the money we needed. And when the dough ran out, I didn't think about anything much, just roamed the streets looking for another job, I told Mam, hoping, I suppose, to get me hands on another 500 nicker, so as the nice life we'd got used to could go on and on forever. Because it's surprising how quick you can get used to a different life. To begin with, the adverts on the telly had shown us how much more there was in the world to buy than we'd ever dreamed of when we looked into shop windows but hadn't seen all there was to see because we didn't have the money to buy it with anyway. And the telly made all these things seem 20 times better than we'd ever thought they were. Even adverts at the cinema were cool and tame because now we were seeing them in private at home. We used to cock our noses up at things in shops that didn't move. But suddenly we saw their real value because they jumped and glittered round the screen and had some pasty-faced tart going head over heels to get her nail polish grabbers onto them or her lipstick lips over them, not like the crummy adverts you saw on posters or in newspapers as dead as doornails. These were flickering around, loose, half-open packets and tins, making you think that all you had to do was finish opening them before they were yours. Like seeing an unlocked safe through a shop window, with the man gone away for a cup of tea without thinking to guard his lolly. The films they showed were good as well in that way, because we couldn't get our eyes unglued from the cops chasing the robbers who had satchel bags crammed with cash and looked like getting away to spend it until the last moment. I always hoped they would end up free to blow the lot and could never stop wanting to put me hand out, smash into the screen and get the copper in a half Nelson so as he'd stop following the bloke with the money bags. Even when he'd knocked off a couple of bank clerks, I hoped he wouldn't get nabbed. In fact, then I wished more than ever he wouldn't, because it meant the hot chair if he did. And I wouldn't wish that on anybody, no matter what they'd done, because I'd read in a book where the hot chair weren't a quick death at all, but that you just sat there, scorching to death until you were dead. And it was when these cops were chasing the crooks that we played some good tricks with the telly. Because when one of them opened his big gob to spout about getting their man, I'd turn the sound down and see his mouth move like a goldfish or a mackerel or a minnow, mimicking what they were supposed to be acting. It was so funny, the whole family nearly went into fits on the brand new carpet that hadn't yet found its way to the bedroom. It was the best of all, though, when we did it to some Tory telling us about how good his government was going to be if we kept on voting for them. Their slack chops rolling, opening and bumbling, hands lifting to twitch moustaches and touching the buttonholes to make sure the flower hadn't wilted so that you could see they didn't mean a word they said. Especially with not a murmur coming out because we'd cut the sound off. When the governor of the Borstal first talked to me, I was reminded of those times so much that I nearly killed myself trying not to laugh. Yes, we played so many good stunts on that box of tricks that Mam used to call us the telly boys. We got so clever at it. My pal Mike got let off with probation because it was his first job, anyway the first they ever knew about, and because they said he would never have done it if it hadn't been for me talking him into it. They said I was a menace to honest lads like Mike, and that I was the brains behind the job, the guiding light when it came to making up anybody's mind. But I swear to God, I weren't out like that, because really, I ain't got no more brain than a gnat after hiding the money in the place I did. And I, being cranky like I am, got sent to Borstal, because to tell you the honest truth, I'd been to Remandones before. Though that's another story, and I suppose if I ever tell it, it'll be just as boring as this one is. I was glad, though, that Mike got away with it, and I only hope he always will, not like silly bastard me. So on this foggy night, we tore ourselves away from the telly and slammed the front door behind us, setting off up our wide streets like slow tugs on a river that had broken their hooters, for we didn't know where the house fronts began, what with the perishing cold mist all around. I was snatched to death without an overcoat. Mam had forgotten to buy me one in the scrummage of shopping, and by the time I thought to remind her of it, the dough was all gone. So we whistled the Teddy Boys' Picnic to keep us warm, and I told myself that I'd get a coat soon if it was the last thing I did. Mike said he thought the same about himself, adding that he'd also get some brand new glasses with gold rims to wear instead of the wire frames they'd given him at the school clinic years ago. He didn't twig it was foggy at first and cleaned his glasses every time I pulled him back from a lamppost to car. But when he saw the lights on Alfreton Road looking like octopus eyes, he put them in his pocket and didn't wear them again until we did the job. We hadn't got 2 halfpennies between us, and though we weren't hungry, we wished we'd got a bob or two when we passed the fish and chip shops, because the delicious sniffs of salt and vinegar and frying fat made our mouths water. I don't mind telling you, we walked the town from one end to the other, and if our eyes weren't glued to the ground looking for lost wallets and watches, they were swivelling around house windows and shop doors in case we saw something easy and worth nipping into. Neither of us said as much as this to the other, but I know for a fact that that was what we was thinking. What I don't know, and as sure as I sit here I know I'll never know, is which of us was the first bastard to latch his peepers onto that baker's backyard. Oh, yes, it's all right, me telling myself it was me, but the truth is I'll never know whether it was Mike or not, because I do know that I didn't see the open window until he stabbed me in the ribs and pointed it out. "See it?" he said. "Yes," I told him, "so let's get cracking." "But what about the wall, though?" he whispered, looking a bit closer. "On your shoulders," I chipped in. His eyes were already up there. "Will you be able to reach?" It was the only time he ever showed any life. "Leave it to me," I said, ever ready. "I can reach anywhere from your hammock shoulders." Mike was a nipper compared to me, but underneath the scruffy draft-board jersey he wore were muscles as hard as iron, and you wouldn't think it to see him walking down the street with glasses on and hands in his pockets that he'd arm a fly. But I never liked to get on the wrong side of him in a fight, because he's the sort that don't say a word for weeks on end, sits plugged in front of the telly, or reads a cowboy book, or just sleeps. Then suddenly, biff, half kills somebody for almost nothing at all, such as beating him in a race for the last football post on a Saturday night, pushing in front of him at the bus stop, or bumping into him when he was daydreaming about Dolly on the tub next door. I saw him set on a bloke once for no more than fixing him in a funny way with his eyes, and it turned out that the bloke was cockeyed. But nobody knew it, because he'd just that day come to live in our street. At other times, none of these things would matter a bit, and I suppose the only reason why I was pals with him was because I didn't say much from one month's end to the other either. He puts his hands up in the air like he was being covered with a Gatling gun, and moves to the wall like he was going to be mowed down, and I climbed up him like he was a style of stepladder, and not a sound of a breath nor the shiver of a flinch coming from him. I lost no time in any case, took my coat from between my teeth, chucked it up to the glass-topped wall, where the glass weren't too sharp because the jags had been worn down by years of accidental stones, and was sitting astraddle before I knew where I was. Then down the other side, with my legs rammed up into my throat when I hit the ground, the crack coming about as hard as when you fall after a high parachute drop, that one of my mates told me was like jumping off a 12-foot wall, which this must have been. Then I picked up my bits and pieces and opened the gate for Mike, who was still grinning and full of life because the hardest part of the job was already done. "I came, I broke, I entered," like that clever Dick Borstal song. I didn't think about anything at all as usual, because I never do when I'm busy, when I'm draining pipes, looting sacks, yaling locks, lifting latches, forcing me bony hands and lanky legs into making something move, hardly feeling me lungs going in whiff and out waff, not realising whether my mouth is clamped tight or gaping, whether I'm hungry, itching from scabies, or whether my flies are open and flashing dirty words like muck and spit into the late night final fog. And when I don't know anything about all this, then how can I, honest to God, say I think of anything at such times? When I'm wondering what's the best way to get a window open or how to force a door, how can I be thinking or have anything on my mind? That's what that four-eyed, white-smocked bloke with the notebook couldn't understand when he asked me questions for days and days after I got to Borstal. And I couldn't explain it to him then, like I'm writing it down now. And even if I'd been able to, Maybe you still wouldn't have caught on, because I don't know whether I can understand it myself even at this moment. Though I'm doing my best, you can bet. So before I knew where I was inside the baker's office, watching Mike picking up that cash box after he'd struck a match to see where it was, wearing a tailor-made 50-shilling grin on his square, crew-cut nut, as his paws closed over the box like he'd squash it to nothing. Out, he suddenly said, shaking it so as it rattled. Let's scram. Maybe there's some more, I said, pulling half a dozen drawers out of a roller-top desk. No, he said, like he'd already been 20 years in the game. This is the lot, patting his tin box. This is it. I pulled out another few drawers, full of bills, books and letters. How do you know, you loony sod? He barged past me like a bull at a gate, because I do. Right or wrong, we'd both got to stick together and do the same thing. I looked at an ever-loving babe of a brand-new typewriter, but knew it was too traceable, so I blew it a kiss and went out after him. Hang on, I said, pulling the door to. We're in no hurry. Not much we aren't, he said over his shoulder. We've got months to splash the lolly, I whispered as we crossed the yard. Only don't let that gate creak too much, or you'll have the narcs tuning in. You think I'm balmy, he said, creaking the gate so that the whole street heard. I don't know about Mike, but now I started to think of how we'd get back safe through the streets with that money box up me jumper, because he'd clapped it into my hand as soon as we got to the main road, which might have meant that he'd started thinking as well, which only goes to show how you don't know what's in anybody else's mind unless you think about things yourself. But as far as my thinking went at that moment, it wasn't up to much, only a bit of fright that wouldn't budge not even with a hot blow lamp, about what we'd say if a copper asked us where we were off to with that hump in me guts. What is it, he'd ask, and I'd say, a growth. What do you mean, a growth, he'd say back narky-like. I'd cough and clutch myself like I was in the most tripe-twisting pain in the world and screw me eyes up like I was on my way to the hospital, and Mike would take me arm like he was the best pal I'd got. Cancer, I'd managed to say to Narka, which would make his slow, punch-drunk brain suspect a thing or two. A lad of your age? So I'd groan again and hoped to make him feel a real bully of a bastard, which would be impossible, but anyway. It's in the family. Dad died of it last month, and I'll die of it next month by the feel of it. What, did he have it in the guts? No, in the throat, but it's got me in the stomach, groan and cough. Well, you shouldn't be out like this if you've got cancer. You should be in the hospital. I'd get ratty now. That's why I'm trying to go, if only you'd let me, and stop asking so many questions, aren't I, Mike? But then just in time, the copper would tell us to get on our way, kind and considerate all of a sudden, saying that the outpatient department of the hospital closes at 12, so hadn't he better call us a taxi? He would if we liked, he said, and he'd pay for it as well. But we tell him not to bother, that he's a good bloke even if he's a copper, that we know a shortcut anyway. Then just as we're turning a corner, he gets it into his big batchy head that we're going the opposite way to the hospital, and he calls us back, so we start to run. If you can call that thinking. Up in my room, Mike rips open that money box with a hammer and chisel, and before we know where we are, we've got £78.15 and 4d. each, lying all over my bed like tea spread out on Christmas Day. Cake and trifle, salad and sandwiches, jam tarts and bars of chocolate, all shared and shared alike between Mike and me, because we believed in equal work and equal pay. Just like the comrades my dad was in, until he couldn't do a stroke anymore and had no breath left to argue with. I thought how good it was that blokes like that poor baker didn't stash all his cash in one of them big marble-fronted banks that take up every corner of the town. How lucky for us that he didn't trust them, no matter how many millions of tons of concrete, or how many iron bars and boxes they were made of, or how many coppers kept their blue pop-eyed peepers glued to them. How smashing it was that he believed in money boxes, when so many shopkeepers thought it old-fashioned and tried to be modern by using a bank, which wouldn't give a couple of sincere, honest, hard-working, conscientious blokes like Mike and me a chance. Now you'd think, and I'd think, And anybody with a bit of imagination would think that we'd done as clean a job as could ever be done, that with the baker's shop being at least a mile from where we lived, with not a soul having seen us, and what with the fog and the fact that we weren't more than 5 minutes in the place, that the coppers should never have been able to trace us. But then you'd be wrong. I'd be wrong, and everybody else would be wrong, no matter how much imagination was diced out between us. Even so, Mike and I didn't splash the money about, because that would have made people think straight away that we'd latched onto something that didn't belong to us, which wouldn't do at all, because even in a street like ours, there are people who love to do a good turn for the coppers, though I never know why they do. Some people are so mean-gutted that even if they've only got tuppence more than you, and they think you're the sort that would take it if you have half the chance, they'd get you put inside if they saw you ripping lead out of a lavatory, even if it weren't their lavatory, just to keep their tuppence out of your reach. So we didn't do anything to let on how rich we were. Nothing like going downtown and coming back dressed in brand new teddy boy suits and carrying a set of skiffle drums like another pal of ours who'd done a factory job about 6 months before. No, we took the odd bobs and pennies out and folded the notes into bundles and stuffed them up the drain pipe outside the door in the backyard. Nobody'll ever think of looking for it there, I said to Mike. We'll keep it doggo for a week or two, then take a few quid out at a time till it's all gone. We might be thieving bastards, but we're not green. Some days later, a plainclothes Dick knocked at the door and asked for me. I was still in bed at 11 o'clock and had to unroll myself from the comfortable black sheets when I heard Mam calling me. A man to see you, she said. Hurry up or he'll be gone. I could hear her keeping him at the back door, nattering about how fine it had been, but how it looked like rain since early this morning. And he didn't answer her, except to snap out a snotty yes or no. I scrambled into my trousers and wondered why he'd come, knowing it was a copper, because a man to see you always meant just that in our house. And if I'd had any idea that one had gone to Mike's house as well at the same time, I'd have twigged it to be because of that 150 quid's worth of paper stuffed up the drainpipe outside the back door, about 10 inches away from that plainclothes copper's boot, where Mam still talked to him, thinking she was doing me a favour, and I wishing to God she'd ask him in, though on second thoughts, realising that that would seem more suspicious than keeping him outside, because they know we hate their guts, and smell a rat if they think we're trying to be nice to them. Mam wasn't born yesterday, I thought, thumping me way down the creaking stairs. I'd seen him before. Borstal Bernard in Nicky hat, remand home Ronald in rowing boat boots, probation Pete in a pit prop Macintosh, 3 months Clink in collar and tie. A tech who'd never had as much in his pockets as that drainpipe had up its jacksie. He was like Hitler in the face, right down to the paintbrush tash, except that being 6 foot tall made him seem worse. But I straightened my shoulders to look into his illiterate blue eyes, like I always do with any copper. Then he started asking me questions, and my mother from behind said, "He's never left that television set for the last 3 months, so you've got an out on him, mate. You might as well look for somebody else, because you're wasting the rates you get out of my rent and the income tax that comes out of my pay packet, standing there like that." Which was a laugh, because she'd never paid either, to my knowledge. Never would have hoped. "You know where Papplewick Street is, don't you?" the copper asked me, taking no notice of Mam. "Ain't it off Alfreton Road?" I asked him back. "You know there's a baker's halfway down on the left-hand side, don't you?" "Ain't it next door to a pub, then?" I wanted to know. He answered me sharp, "No, it bloody well ain't." Coppers always lose their tempers as quick as this, and more often than not they gain nothing by it. "Then I don't know it," I told him, saved by the bell. He slid his big boot round and round on the doorstep. "Where were you last Friday night?" Back in the ring, but this was worse than a boxing match. I didn't like him trying to accuse me of something he wasn't sure I'd done. "Was I at that baker's you mentioned, or in the pub next door?" "You'll get 5 years in Borstal if you don't give me a straight answer," he said, unbuttoning his mac even though it was cold where he was standing. I was glued to the telly, like Mam says, I swore blind. But he went on and on with his loony questions. "Have you got a television?" The things he asked wouldn't have taken in a kid of two. And what else could I say to the last one except, as the aerial fell down, would you like to come in and see it? He was liking me even less for saying that. We know you weren't listening to the television set last Friday, and so do you, don't you? Perhaps not. But I was looking at it, because sometimes we turn the sound down for a bit of fun. I could hear Mam laughing from the kitchen, and I hoped Mike's man was doing the same if the cops had gone to him as well. We know you weren't in the house, he said, starting up again, cranking himself with the handle. They always say we, never I, as if they feel braver and righter, knowing there's a lot of them against only one. I've got witnesses, I said to him. Man for one, a fancy man for two, ain't that enough? I can get you a dozen more, a 13 altogether if it was a baker's that got robbed. I don't want no lies, he said, not catching on about the baker's dozen. Where do they scrape cops up from anyway? All I want is to get from you where you put that money. Don't get mad, I kept saying to myself, don't get mad. Hearing Mam setting out cups and saucers and putting the pan on the stove for bacon. I stood back and waved him inside like he was a butler. Come and search the house, if you've got a warrant. Listen, my lad, he said, like the dirty, bullying, jumped-up bastard he was. I don't want too much of your lip, because if we get you down to the Guildhall, you'll get a few bruises and black eyes for your trouble. And I knew he wasn't kidding either, because I'd heard about all them sort of tricks. I hope one day, though, that him and all his pals would be the ones to get the black eyes and kicks. He never knew. It might come sooner than anybody thinks, like in Hungary. Tell me where the money is, and I'll let you off with probation. What money? I asked him, because I'd heard that one before as well. You know what money. Do I look as if I know out about money? I said, pushing me fist through a hole in me shirt. The money that was pinched, that you know all about. He said, you can't trick me, so it's no use trying. Was it 3 1/2 halfpenny, I asked. You thieving young bastard, we'll teach you to steal money that doesn't belong to you. I turned my head around. Ma'am, I called out, get me lawyer on the blower, will you? Clever, aren't you, he said, in a very unfriendly way. Look, I pleaded, as if I was about to sob me socks off because he'd got me wrong. It's all very well, us talking like this. It's like a game, almost. But I wish you'd tell me what it's all about, because, honest to God, I've just got out of bed, and here you are at the door, talking about me having pinched a lot of money, money that I don't know anything about. He swung around now as if he'd trapped me, though I couldn't see why he might think so. Who said anything about money? I didn't. What made you bring money into this little talk we're having? It's you, I answered, thinking he was going balmy and about to start foaming at the chops. You've got money on the brain, like all policemen. Baker's shops as well. He screwed his face up. I want an answer from you. Where's that money? But I was getting fed up with all this. I'll do a deal. And judging by his flashbulb face, he thought he was suddenly onto a good thing. What sort of a deal? So I told him, I'll give you all the money I've got. 1 4/2 halfpenny. If you stop this third degree and let me go in and get my breakfast. Honest, I'm clammed to death. I haven't had a bite since yesterday. Can't you hear me guts rolling? His jaw dropped, but on he went, pumping me for another half hour. Routine checkup, as they say on the pictures. But I knew I was winning on points. Then he left, but he came back in the afternoon to search the house. He didn't find a thing, not a French farthing. He asked me questions again, and I didn't tell him anything except lies. Lies, lies. Because I can go on doing that forever without batting an eyelid. He'd got nothing on me, and we both of us knew it. Otherwise I'd have been down to the Guildhall in no time. But he kept on keeping on because I'd been in a remand home for a high wall job before. And Mike was put through the same mill because all the local cops knew he was my best pal. When it got dark, me and Mike were in our parlour with a low light on and the telly off, Mike taking it easy in the rocking chair and me slouched on the settee, both of us puffing on a packet of woods. With the door bolted and curtains drawn, we talked about the dough we'd crammed up the drainpipe. Mike thought we should take it out and both of us do a bunk to Skegness or Cleethorpes for a good time in the arcades, living like lords in a boarding house near the pier. Then at least we'd both have had a big beano before getting sent down. "Listen, you daft bleeder," I said. "We aren't going to get caught at all, and we'll have a good time later." We were so clever, we didn't even go out to the pictures, though we wanted to. In the morning, old Hitlerface questioned me again, with one of his pals this time. And the next day they came, trying as hard as they could to get something out of me, but I didn't budge an inch. I know I'm showing off when I say this, but in me he'd met his match, and I'd never give in to questions, no matter how long it was kept up. They searched the house a couple of times as well, which made me think they thought they really had something to go by, but I know now that they hadn't, and that it was all buckshee speculation. They turned the house upside down and inside out like an old sock, went from top to bottom and front to back, but naturally they didn't find a thing. The copper even poked his face into the front room chimney that hadn't been swept for years and came down, looking like Al Jolson, and so that he had to swill himself clean at the scullery sink. They kept tapping and pottering around the big aspidistra plant that Grandma had left to Mam, lifting it up from the table to look under the cloth, putting it aside so as they could move the table and get at the boards under the rug. The big-headed, stupid, ignorant bastards never once thought of emptying the soil out of the plant pot, where they'd have found the crumpled-up money box that we buried the night before we did the job. I suppose it's still there now I think about it. And I suppose Mam wonders now and again why the plant don't prosper like it used to, as if it could, with a fistful of thick black tin lapped round its guts.